we'll talk about something that's hard for a lot of people, saying no. Research shows that turning people down can be so difficult that people will even agree to unethical requests just to avoid saying no.
Elizabeth Bernstein wrote about saying no in her latest column. She writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Why is it so hard for people to say no?
Well, you, in a nutshell, we want to get along. We are pleasers, most of us, or at least we want people to like us. It's very important to be part of communities. So it's very hard then to feel like we're rejecting somebody when we say no to them.
And how does not saying no get us into trouble when it comes to our busy work and personal lives?
Well, we're all, as you say, so busy. We're almost overwhelmed. I mean, the kids, two jobs, you know, just everything, the pace of modern life with technology. And so we have requests coming at us from all areas, from our families, from our friends, from bosses, coworkers, and charities. It goes on and on. And so if we don't learn to say no, we'll get nothing done. We really have to protect what's important to us and what we most want to get done. To protect our priorities, we really have to learn to manage them. And doing that is saying no to the ones that are not that important to us.
And I think that the ones who are not that important to us tend to feel bad when we say no. At least that's what it seems like we're worried about, that when we say no to somebody, we're going to hurt their feelings and we're going to damage a relationship no matter what level that relationship is at. Is that true? How damaging is saying no?
Well, it is exactly that. That's what we're worried about, that we are going to hurt someone's feelings. We're going to let them down. You know, it's true, actually. Our brains react more strongly to negative information than they do to positive. So when someone hears a no, they do have a pretty strong reaction just in their brain. Neuroscience shows us that. But at the same time, there's something out there that researchers call the harshness bias. And what this is that we feel others will judge us more than they actually will. We're worried that the, you know, sort of the amount of hurt that we're going to give or the amount of criticism we're going to get is worse than it will actually be. So yes, people will be hurt when we say no, probably, but it won't be as bad. They won't be as devastated as we think they will be.
Well, and that gap is probably where the trouble comes from, the difference between how bad they'll really feel and how bad we expect they'll feel if we say no to whatever the request is.
Exactly. So in that gap is where all the problems happen.
So how do we get around that then? So we know we've got this gap. We know we'll be better off if we learn to say no. How do we take those first steps and start to get more comfortable with it?
Well, it's interesting. I talk to sort of therapists and other experts, psychologists on this, and they say that the number one thing you want to do is plan ahead. So you want to have sort of a no in your back pocket. You want to have a ready-to-use answer for requests of any kind, really, that you don't think you can do. So you want to have it. It should be polite. When you deliver it, it should be gentle. You don't want to just shout out, no, I would never do that. You know, so you want to sort of say, I'm sorry, but I cannot do that. But it also should be definitive, exactly that. You know, I cannot do that. So, you know, those are the big ones. Also, another interesting, important thing to do would be to learn not to say yes on the spot. So maybe you get blindsided, you're at work, coworker asks you, you know, hey, can you drive me home tomorrow, whatever it is, and you can't do it, you need to say, you know what, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. So you want to learn not to say yes just because you're put on the spot and you don't know what else to say.
One of our WPR colleagues has a running joke along these lines. If you ask him to do something, he'll say, no, I have anything else to do at that time. And I assume we need something a little more polite than that.
I have something else to do. There you go. It's just anything will do. I'm not doing what you want.
And in terms of the research on this, there is actual research about people being biased against saying no, isn't there? People will go to incredible lengths to say yes or to avoid saying no is more the point.
Exactly. People will go to incredible lengths to not have the uncomfortableness of saying no. So researchers do study this, and they also know that if we say a no one time, if we decline a request, we're more likely to say yes the next time, simply because of the guilt of saying no that first time. But researchers study saying no, and in one study that I liked, they asked people, they got a whole bunch of college students to go up to strangers with a library book. The college students had the library book. They asked these strangers to deface replace the library book by writing the word pickle in it in pen. And they had predicted the students, they'd asked the students, predict how many people do you think will do this? And the students said, oh, about 29% of people will do this. It turned out it was half the people said, oh, okay, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing this, but I'll do it. They'd rather write pickle in a library book than say no and hurt the feelings of a stranger.
Is there a certain personality type that has more trouble with this than others?
There are. You know, anybody who is a pleaser, who, you know, wants to please, there's people who are conflict adverse. They don't like to be in any kind of uncomfortable situation where there's an argument or a conflict. Those people, there are people who just habitually say yes to everything, sort of the so-called doormats who just, you know, never, ever step up and say no and protect themselves.
Is there any research on whether it's better, in terms of the reaction we have in our brains when we hear no, whether it's better to have someone just say a flat-out no or to have someone say yes but then you keep stringing the other person along, say an office mate who keeps wanting to clean out the office.
Just hypothetically.
And that office mate keeps canceling the cleanup date and week after week goes by and the office never gets cleaned out.
You know, I don't know of any particular research on that, but I did ask psychologists that, and they say that it is better to be upfront. And so where you get yourself into a problem is stringing the other person along.
Uh-huh.
Because now you have to basically, if you're saying yes and you really mean no, you're lying. Or, you know, you're just at the very best, you're putting off your decision to say no or the uncomfortableness of saying no. And so you're stringing it out, but you also are having to say it over and over. So it's better for both of you to say, look, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be up for cleaning that office. I'm perfectly good with the mess as it is.
So the takeaway is that Rob is a liar.
Hey, whoa. We can get into this off air.
Okay.
Operation Cleansing Flame will be a reality at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our society, Elizabeth, we're often confronted with people who won't take no for an answer, whether it's a friend, a boss, somebody soliciting money on the phone, who their job in some ways is to break down that initial no, or a salesperson. How hard does that make it? How can we inure ourselves to that?
It makes it so much harder. So, yes, a lot of people, it is their job and they are trained well to make sure that they do not take no for an answer. So, moms are among that group, by the way, too. What you need to do is stand firm, and that makes it even harder. So, you said no one time, and now you have to say it a bunch more, but you need to learn to do that. So again, the experts will say you stay polite and you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And no matter how many times that person says, but are you sure you don't really want to buy, you know, these bonds I'm selling, then you keep saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. You just have to keep repeating the same thing over and over.
So the same thing over and over, is it important to just use that pattern, something that diffuses or defangs the other person quicker?
Well, because you want to get rid of them, right? You don't want them to keep coming back at you. So you don't want to say, you don't want to put them off. Well, you know, call me next week. But you don't, if you keep varying your excuses, they might be seeing a hole in there. Well, this excuse was this today, and yesterday it was something else. You know, so you just want to, you don't even owe an excuse in many cases. You do if it's someone you're close to or a family member. You know, grandma, I can't come over this weekend. I'm really sorry. You know, the kids are sick. It has to be something specific if you're close to them, but you do not owe failed salespeople an answer on why. You don't owe them an explanation, just no, and you keep repeating it.
In our lives, though, there will be times when it'll be better off for everyone if we say yes. Assuming we take the time after that initial request, don't immediately say yes, how do we start doing that mental triage that, yeah, this is something I can prioritize and know that other thing isn't?
Meaning, when you say yes, but you really wanted to say no.
Or no, how do we figure out when we don't give that initial yes answer? How do we sit back, take a step away, and then make that decision? Yeah, this is something I ought to do.
Well, so that's why, again, you don't want to give an answer right away. So you say, let me sit on that, let me sleep on that, and then you think about it, and you're right. There are times, many times really, especially with family or your boss, that you're better off saying yes, even if it's something you didn't want to do or squeezing it in. And so then you really have to think, like, you know, I'm not the only person here that has to be happy with this decision. Will the most amount of people be happier? Will it benefit my family? Will it benefit my job? You know, you want to ask yourself these questions, like what's the upside of doing this? And you may find out that it's not that hard to see that it's something you should do.
We're talking to Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about how to say no more effectively.
And what about you? Do you have a hard time saying no? Have you ever agreed to something you didn't want to do just because it was easier than saying no? And what strategies do you have? You can call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send us email to talk@WPR.org. We're picking up our conversation about the difficulty lots of us have saying no and how to overcome it with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. She tweets at EBernsteinWSJ.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have trouble saying no? Are you too busy, constantly overwhelmed because you say yes whenever you're asked to do this or that at work or away from work? Or have you learned how to say no? What's been the benefit of that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Elizabeth, we talked about some of the techniques we can use to learn to say no. One of them is repeating the same words over and over again, or giving yourself space to think about it and maybe building up to that no. What about tone of voice? Does that matter?
It does matter. Being a gentle, sort of calm tone of voice, what happens is I think some of us feel that we just get pushed too far. We're spread thin to begin with. Then someone's coming at us with a request, and we, try to say no, but we really waffle out of it. And, you know, by the time we really decide we need to say no, we're just shouting it out or, you know, snapping and saying, no, I can't. So you want to be gentle and polite, very polite, and just say, look, I wish I could, but I cannot. I am sorry. So, tone does matter a lot.
And how about hedging? Like, well, not this time, but maybe next year, or maybe sometime, but not now.
Well, by doing that, they've got you. So maybe next year, they're coming right back at you next year. So probably charities love this because they just put you right on their list for next year. So, you know, no should be no unless you want them to come back next year. Maybe, you know, you just this year you're done with these requests, but next year you have time. But if you don't want them to come back, forget it. It's like telling a telemarketer, yeah, call me next week. No, you don't want to hear from them next week, so...
Do you have any stories about people who did harness the power of saying no and how it changed their lives?
I did. I have stories of people who learned how they sort of taught themselves how to say no. One woman was, she said she's very petite and sort of had a gentle voice, but she was also a pretty big executive, and people would not really take no, especially she was always asked to sit on charity boards, and they wouldn't necessarily take no for an answer. She felt they didn't take her seriously when she tried to push back. She was spread thin. She was on too many boards. So she said she would stand on her office chair. She would get up on her office chair to make herself feel stronger and taller and bigger, and she would sort of growl no at them. So it did backfire once when her boss walked in, but other than that, I think it worked out okay for her. She even told me her tips on balancing on the swivel chair. She
wow.
said, you put one knee on the desk.
Don't try this at home. Well, Elizabeth, I know people and you have readers, and often when you write things like this, it touches a nerve with a lot of people. Is this one of those? Do you keep hearing from people who say, oh my God, this is my life?
Yeah, I do. People say, wow, like, that's me. You know, not everybody. Of course, there are people who have no trouble at all saying no. It's just their knee-jerk reaction to almost anything. But, most people, a lot of people wrote me and said, you know, this is me. Thank you. I hate letting people down. Or, you know, and what's interesting, too, is there's not research that shows whether men and women are different. But the experts who study it say, anecdotally, they believe that women have a harder time saying no, and that's because women are they're conditioned to be the connectors in society and in their families. They're the ones that have to keep all the relationships going, and so they're really juggling so many more balls in the air, so it's hard to let people down. But men are conditioned to, you know, provide for their families. And so with that goal in mind, and it's very easy for them to say, well, no, this doesn't fit into that goal, so of course I wouldn't do that.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have Marcus with us from Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I recently volunteered to give an older gentleman a ride home from the food pantry with his groceries. One thing led to another, and I was bringing him for rides all over the place. And one day he called me. I was shoveling snow, and I carefully explained to him that I couldn't do it. He wouldn't take no for an answer, and this went on and on and on until finally I wouldn't answer the phone, and there were messages, tons of messages. And finally he sent over the police because he was supposedly concerned. They told me to block the phone, that they know this gentleman. And now I find out he's slandering my name up and down this strip of businesses where I live, blaming me for all his woes. So, what, you know, I have a note in my wallet with three sentences explaining that I'm not responsible for him or his personal problems. Mm-hmm. How should I feel about this? I do feel a bit of anger and yet sympathy for
gotcha.
The person.
So, Marcus, I want to get Elizabeth in on this. Unfortunate, you know, a good deed done there, but taken advantage of, I guess, and an expectation that he'd keep doing things for a person.
Exactly. This person had an expectation. It's very hard. I can appreciate how you feel, because you probably feel guilty as well. Like, you know, you're somebody who needs help, and you know, but I can't step up all the time. But you're right. Your note in your wallet is correct. You're not responsible for someone else. You did a good deed. If you want to do a good deed again, that's great. Hopefully it will not escalate in the future with someone else. But also, my guess is someone that is that, I mean, I shouldn't say anything bad, but my guess is someone that latches on to you, a stranger, and will not let go, probably has some other problems too, thinking correctly. And so this is not even somebody who sort of has an ability to lead his life pretty well, I'm guessing. So you should all know this person doesn't probably think correctly. It's not my fault. It's not my responsibility to take care of it. And don't let that stop you, though, from trying to do more good deeds.
And we have a caller who couldn't stay on the line who asks, how can a business communicate a change of policy to customers who might not like the new change without losing the customer? So for businesses who, you know, that the old credo, the customer is always right, how do they handle that?
I think you would want to explain it certainly very carefully why you're doing this, why you have to change whatever the thing is you're changing. But also, if people are upset, listen to them. Listen to them carefully and say, I'm upset. Don't just keep telling them, oh, well, this is good for you, if they feel that it's not. Say, I'm really sorry. I really hear you, but unfortunately, this is the change we had to make. I think sometimes when people feel heard, that's enough. You know, they don't need you to do what they want as long as they do feel you at least heard them.
We also had a note from Reed in Clintonville who says, when I get a telemarketer on the phone, I engage that person in conversation and ask lots of questions about themselves, where they're from, because they don't want to talk about themselves. They want to make a sale. They get off the phone pretty quickly. So I guess divert and change the subject a little bit to say no.
Totally. Yeah, change all the rules on them. But the problem is, what if you get a chatty one? You'll be on there forever. But that's a good strategy. Might want to try it.
Did you meet anyone who is a super no-sayer and just really went to town with it and employed it all the time? I'm just curious about, you know, whether in general people do say no or say yes too often, and if they really just, you know, the opposite of saying yes all the time, if they say no all the time, they're happier.
I think people who say no all the time, well, I don't know if they're happier. I haven't met somebody, as you said, but I've witnessed it. I've seen people who are very good at this. And I don't know if they're happier, but I do imagine that they have more time for their own priorities and their own things they want to do. So perhaps they really are happier. The only drawback would be, you know, are they making the connections they need to make and sustaining them? If they're making people mad, you know, then they're, you know, they may not be happier, but maybe they're saying no effectively and politely, and then going off and doing things that they like to do.
How are you at saying no, Elizabeth? We're glad you say yes when people ask you to come on Midwestern public radio programs. Keep doing that. But apart
you.
From important things like that, how are you on this whole yes-no thing?
I am not so good, depending on who it is. So if it's a family member, if it's my mom, if it's a good friend, like it's hard for me to say no then. But, you know, so I'm learning. That's one reason I needed to write the article.
Are there different cultures that are better at saying no? I wonder sometimes if it's a peculiar American thing that we really want to keep saying yes.
You know, I don't know about the research about that, but I would guess that Americans are, you know, have a good day. They're known, you know, sort of around the world for being people who have sort of almost what reads to other cultures as almost like a fake politeness. And so, you know, maybe somewhere in there we say, you know, yes a lot. So I don't really know the answer, but my guess is Americans could use some lessons in saying no.
And I wonder about, you know, habits of highly effective people and success in the business world and that sort of thing. If there's a rivalry in schools of thought between, yeah, say yes, get involved, get things done, you'll impress people, versus no, don't take on too much, focus on what you're doing and do it well.
I think it is. It's a balance that you have to strike. So, because if you're saying yes across the board, I mean, this is also the work-family balance. If you're saying, you know, yes to everything, you're not going to be able to prioritize and move forward on the things that are important. So you can't just say yes to everything across your company because your own boss is going to be upset. You know, why aren't you doing, you know, what my department needs you to do? So it's probably a balance that you really have to work at continuously.
And you talked about women, but if you look at, you know, for instance, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In campaign, which involves saying yes an awful lot and then some, maybe to get things done, it's just the wrong way to go, leaning in. I don't know. Have you thought about leaning in and saying no?
Well, I know some of the criticism for leaning in, which, you know, so many people, you know, think is so interesting and good. But I have heard some of the criticism is that, you know, it's nice if you have a big support network. So you can say yes to everything if you've got a staff to help you, nannies and housekeepers and all of these things. But if it's just you, you know, raising your kids, going to work, keeping your family going, and all the other things, you know, wanting to give some money to charity, say, but you can't give it all away. So you do, no matter what, even if you do lean in, you still need to prioritize.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. Will you come on again sometime?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, yay.
Good answer.
That was Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We've got a link to her article on saying no on our Central Time Facebook page. If you traveled to your local county fair over the summer or even the state fair, there's a good chance you saw the hard work of the state's 4-H members. While this year was mostly business as usual for the kids involved in the organization, 2014 is a special year for 4-H as it celebrates its 100th anniversary.
While the organization is probably best known for its agricultural roots, 4-H is looking toward new initiatives to ensure that it stays relevant to today's kids and sticks around for another 100 years.
Here to talk about the organization's past and to give us a glimpse of 4-H's future is Dale Lighthizer. He's the State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. He joins us here in the studio. Dale, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
Well, first, congratulations, 100 years, big deal. What is it about 4-H you think that's led it to make it this long?
You know, that's a real good question. I think it goes back in history to really the foundation of our program, going back to the origins of the land-grant university system. In 1863, President Lincoln signed the legislation that granted land to all of our states, and here in Wisconsin, UW-Madison is our original land-grant university. We've really expanded to all of the other institutions around the state as well with our Wisconsin idea. But it goes back to that and really trying to take advantage of the technologies and innovations out of the research of the institution and trying to help people really learn and grow, and at that point in time, 100 years ago, really advance agriculture and try to make farmers more profitable.
Now, for people who don't know what 4-H is all about, how would you describe it?
Boy, that's a really good question. The way I would describe it today is that we are an organization about positive youth development. That's really the focus. I think over the years, we've had different measuring sticks about our program. And the measuring stick in the early 1900s was about hybrid corn. That was the innovation that was part of the research of the land-grant universities, and farmers were not adopting that practice. It really required them to purchase corn seed rather than to just keep back a volume of the fertile seed that they had been used to. And so those innovators back in the early 1900s decided, let's get boys together, have them plant demonstration plots, and from the demonstration to their parents, really encourage the adoption of innovation. So, you know, that was the measuring stick then. What will cause farmers to increase their yield? And over the years, we've had different measuring sticks. And really, the measuring stick today is about preparing young people for their future. And we do that in a lot of different ways. But it's about what happens to young people after they've been in our program and engage in society as adults and become taxpayers, become, working in communities and contributing to our community culture.
Well, we better ask you early on here, what are the 4 H's and what do they mean?
The 4 H's are head, heart, hands, and health. I think it might have been in the 1920s that one of the H's was hustle for a short amount of time, but that got changed into health. And what we take a look at now is we've got elements that are essential to our programs. And we talk about belonging, independence, generosity, and mastery. And it really describes what it is we're after. If we don't have those elements present in our programs, then we're not doing our work to really prepare young people for what happens after they graduate from high school. And one of the most important of those really is belonging. And I think that we all see that with young people and adults as well. If they don't feel like they belong to a group, they're going to walk and they're going to go to a place where they feel like they do belong. So it's really important for us that belonging is the most critical element that has to be there and in place for young people to participate.
So these days, how big a presence is 4-H here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a lot bigger than people really think. You know, we fight the stereotype about 4-H being for young people that are on farms and ranches, engaged in agriculture, raising livestock and crops. And the reality is that in Wisconsin, we have this past year about 355,000 young people across the state in every county from our East Metro region surrounding Milwaukee, lots of young people in Green Bay, up the whole Fox River Valley, and across the rest of the state. So to support those young people, we had about 15,000 volunteers, primarily parents of all of these young people that are really engaging them in communities, in small groups and communities everywhere. So it's not just for those rural agricultural kids, although that's part of our history and heritage, and we've got to have programming available for young people no matter where they happen to live.
Well, and that's reflected in my visits to county fairs and the state fair in the last couple of years. Yes, there's the agricultural stuff we think of, the rabbits and the livestock and the plants, and then the robotics and graphic design. I think talk about some of the non-agricultural fields you've moved into.
You know, it's kind of interesting, and I think that as we take a look at what's happened with education across the board, K-12 in particular, and the research that's come out and the publicity about how young people in the United States are falling behind other countries in relation to science and technology, that there's been a huge push for those fields in particular. And STEM education, as we refer to it today, is about science, technology, engineering, and math. And so we were able to hire a STEM specialist here in Wisconsin 4 years ago who is really helping to lead our effort. Now, we can go back to those corn clubs back in 1904 and really be able to say that was really about STEM education then. Mm-hmm. And throughout our history, we've relied upon research as the foundation of the projects that we've offered. And today we're really trying to put more emphasis into that to really generate interest in young people about fields that relate to science, technology, engineering, and math.
Do you think your image has kept up with the times? Do you think people think about those STEM associations when they think of 4-H, or are they still just thinking about the bunnies and the livestock?
Well, you know, people go to county fairs, and when they do see the livestock and the bunnies and the crops and things that are on exhibit, there are times that it does reinforce some of those stereotypes. But, you know, we've really got to take a look at how we go about marketing and communicating what it is we do, what the results are. And we've had some great long-term research in recent years out of the Tufts University. And that Tufts study points out that young people that are part of our programs are more likely to get A's and B's. They're more likely to be engaged in their communities. Girls in 4-H are more likely to go into science and technology fields and post-high school education, whether that's technical schools or community colleges or four-year colleges. Young people that are in 4-H are less likely to engage in negative behaviors, things that really cost us as a society money. Young people in 4-H are less likely to be in cars where drivers are drinking and driving. They're less likely to text. They're less likely to vandalize. You know, there are a lot of measures that that we've got that really indicate what happens to young people in our program. The long-term benefit is how they contribute to their communities. That's really the bonus. So, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to talk about 4-H in our state and across the country and the results that we have. And, you know, in a way, it's marketing, and we just want to dispel the misconceptions and help people understand what it is we're really all about.
As we talk about 4-H, we'll go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Tina on the line in La Crosse. Tina, hi.
Hi. Yes, I called in to give a compliment. I didn't realize you were going to go more into the technology. Our middle son was really involved in 4-H. He graduated college at Stevens Point and went off to the Peace Corps in Africa. And he found the things he learned in his 4-H projects were more useful than the high-level agricultural and botany studies at a university for actually you know, tribal agriculture in Central Africa. And he actually, I sent him some of his 4-H books that he had, his poultry projects he had through the years.
No kidding. Tina, thank you so much. Is that a story that you hear often, Dale, people looking back on their 4-H practical careers and putting it into practice in Wisconsin or Africa, for that matter?
Oh, yeah. It's been really interesting to me in the past year. I've had calls from or emails from people in a number of different countries who are in 4-H in our state, and they're doing work through the Peace Corps or USAID or other organizations doing international work and wondering how can they use our 4-H materials to support the work they're trying to accomplish in developing countries or in Haiti, where they've had large issues with the earthquake a number of years ago, and people just really taking advantage of not just the resources we have about the subject matter, but the process that we have that stands underneath it.
Thanks for that call, Tina. We're talking with Dale Lighthizer about the 100th anniversary of 4-H, and we want to hear from you, too.
Were you in 4-H when you were a child? And if so, what are some of your memories of your time with the organization? And how do you think the lessons learned in 4-H have benefited you later in life? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Dale Lighthizer, State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. This year marks the 100th anniversary of 4-H, and we're hearing the story of the organization's past century while taking a look at the future as well.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think 4-H is still relevant to today's kids? And what programming would you like to see offered? If you were a 4-H-er anytime in, oh, say, the past 100 years, what was that experience like? Call us at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Rachel on the line in Madison. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was in 4-H for 12 years, and throughout that time was president and secretary of my club, and I also got to go to Australia through it for a month, and it was just a great experience.
Rachel, what were some of the projects that you did over the years in 4-H?
I did poultry, swine, cake decorating, which was one of my big ones, and photography and arts and crafts. So I kind of did a little bit of everything.
Wow. Rachel, thanks so much. That's one of the problems I have with the fair exhibits. There's all these beautiful cakes, and you don't get to eat any of them.
Yeah, but I was just going to ask, Rachel, what are some of the life skills that you really gained from being in 4-H over the years?
Well, we always had to give speeches at our meetings on topics that were important to us. So it helps you, you know, be a better leader and be able to talk to people in public. And we always were doing public service things, you know, cleaning up roads and things like that. So, I mean, it really just, you give back to your community all the time.
Rachel, thanks a lot for sharing that story. She mentioned that time in Australia. So I understand 4-H does international exchange programs.
Yeah, we have a variety of international exchanges. I think a year ago we probably had different kind of exchanges with about 15 different countries around the world. And we've got a bunch of young people that are here in Wisconsin this year. We have year-long exchanges where families can really have an international experience in their own home by hosting a young person in high school, and travel experiences like Rachel has gone on to Australia. So we've got a number of countries that we collaborate with, and Japan is one of those that we have the best relationships with, and we will host about, 50 kids here during the summertime for a 3-week time period. So there are short experiences and longer experiences both for families that are part of our program.
Let's take a comment here on Facebook. This is from Laura, who says, I wasn't fortunate enough to participate in 4-H as a kid, but now I'm involved as a parent and a volunteer leader. I'm amazed by the opportunities that 4-H makes available to my kids: competitive shooting sports, robotics, models, rocketry, swine, llamas, lobbying with lawmakers in Madison, and so much more. We feel so very fortunate to belong to such a fantastic organization. So interesting. You know, I'm on board here, knowing what makes sense with the swine and the llamas, rocketry we talked about, STEM stuff, but lobbying with lawmakers. So 4-H has some programs that are political.
I wouldn't say that it's political, but part of this centennial activity that we've got going on this year is to really do some more public awareness. And because we're part of the land-grant university system, because we're part of the University of Wisconsin, we get funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture through the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. We get funding through the state of Wisconsin, through the university system, and then our big collaborators, cooperators, are county boards across the state as well. So we have these partnerships, and I wouldn't say that it's lobbying, but it's really informing our stakeholders about the work that we do, the progress that we make, and what the public value is of the work in relation to the tax dollars that we receive. And the benefits are far greater than the investments, but it really does take an investment to really get young people to be able to contribute to society in the long run.
We'll get back to our callers. We've got Larry on the line in Dubuque. Larry, hi.
Hi, thanks. To make a long story short, I'm originally from around Chicago and was never in 4-H as a child, but I teach now, and one of my elementary students, I was teaching ukulele to them, like basic chords, that kind of starting info, and I found out over the summer that she had used the lessons as a personal 4-H project, and won, I think it's called Youth Grand Champion, if the name is correct or not, but I never knew that 4-H could stretch across so many different topics other than your typical farming and other stuff like that.
Larry, thanks a lot. Congratulations. Keep teaching that ukulele.
Yeah, we've got a lot of different projects, Larry, and I think that one of the things that young people can do is they can design their own projects as well. What, you know, they can outline what the learning objectives happen to be and really try to develop a course of work where they can explore different topics and be able to exhibit those. And that exhibiting is about demonstrating to others what it is the learning is that's taken place.
Now, you've been talking about a 4-H that's looking forward to the future and some of the STEM aspects that are part of 4-H. What have you done to reach out to kids in urban areas? Because traditionally the image was rural kids with 4-H, but you're getting bigger and expanding and offering new things. So what is the effort there to bring in urban kids?
Yeah, you know, that's a big challenge for us. There are so many opportunities that young people in urban areas have compared to more rural areas. We might be one of the biggest games in town and really rural Wisconsin, but in Milwaukee and Waukesha, Racine, Kenosha, you know, some of those communities, there are a lot of other opportunities that we really compete against. And so it's a challenge for us to really market and change some of those opinions of people. One of the things that we're really starting to take a look at, and I reflect back on Laura's comments about how she wasn't fortunate enough to participate in 4-H as a child, but she is participating as a parent and a volunteer right now. And it's really the word of mouth that has a lot of power with people. And it's some of those first generation families like Laura and her children that are some of the biggest advocates for what it is we do and the benefits that they see for children. So we really rely on word of mouth. We don't have a lot of resources. I think we can all admit freely that that state resources, public funding, has been challenged across the board, and we're subject to that as well. So we really want to take advantage of the word of mouth in communities where people know one another, they trust their neighbors, and if they've got a relationship, that they can really advocate on our behalf.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Lee on the line in Shell Lake. Lee, hi.
Hi. I just had to call in and say what an impression 4-H has had on my life. It's been probably the most important thing. You introduced me to Madison, UW-Madison, through State 4-H Cub Week, through record keeping and leadership opportunities, getting to go to Chicago and Washington, D.C. It made a huge impact on my life.
Lee, thank you so much for sharing that. He mentioned leadership. Is that one of the goals that you're hoping kids take out of 4-H?
Yeah, we've got a life skill model that was developed by a researcher at Iowa State University that identifies 35 different life skills that are part of our program. And it includes things that Lee has just mentioned: leadership, communication skills. Record keeping is something that's really important. Record keeping is one of those things. I'm surprised that no one has talked yet about record books. It seems to be the scorn of young people that are in the program, but for adults that have been part of the program, it's one of those assets that they really appreciate. Hmm. And a skill that it's about record keeping and not record doing. You know, I think all of us that pay taxes on April 14th, if we're doing things at the last minute, we know what a pain that is. And record keeping, being able to do that routinely over the course of the year, is a much better skill for all of us. And it takes a lot of self-discipline to do that.
Let's go back to our phones now. We've got Eddie on the line from Marshfield. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to talk about how 4-H helps young boys and girls develop their skills as leaders. Our daughter joined 4-H about 3 years ago, and we have seen a dramatic change in her development. She has just blossomed as a leader. She is organized, she is poised, she's gone to the legislature to advocate for education. She's gone to Washington, D.C. to meet Congress people. She's just become a very, very organized and poised person. And it's all because she took part in 4-H.
Oh, so interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us, Eddie. You know, I'm intrigued with the number of people talking about the leadership skills gained in 4-H. It might not be the first thing people think of when they think about involvement. Do you want to talk a little bit about why those skills are part and parcel of this program?
Yeah, they get developed at an early age. What we have as our primary program model are clubs. And young people that at a young age, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, might participate on a committee. And being part of a committee that makes a decision is a leadership skill. It's about learning how to work with others. It's learning how to make decisions. It's learning fundamental principles about parliamentary procedure. And developing those skills over time, maybe a person is part of a committee, part of a group, they're talking about the community service they might want to do over the course of the year, and then they become an officer. They might be the club secretary, the club treasurer, where they keep track of things that are going on in the club, take minutes, and work with the checkbook. And eventually, they take more and more leadership positions.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Dale, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me here.
That's Dale Lighthizer. He's the State Program Director for 4-H Youth Development. He joined us to talk about the organization on its 100th anniversary, looking some at its past and their plans for the future. And there's still time for you to share your stories over at the Central Time Facebook page if you have a 4-H memory you'd like to share with us.